guest, Gary McKinney, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, created by Mark and J.P. Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven, and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática con Annie.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm in West Lynn. Portland Tycho blends traditional Japanese Tycho drumming with dynamic choreography and storytelling. That's Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm, 29700 Southwest Mountain Road in West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll speak with author Christina Beltran, Associate Professor at New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. She's the author of The Trouble with Unity, Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity, and she'll join us to discuss her latest book, which is called Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. Then we'll turn to Mark Rank, a professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis, who's an expert on issues of inequality, poverty, and social justice. He'll tell us about his newest book, co-authored with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock, called Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The issue of immigration in America has always been the focus of controversy, racist rhetoric, and cruel policies. Indeed, this is by design, as part of a nation whose origin is built on white supremacy. A new book examines how migrant suffering sustains white democracy. In it, author Christina Beltran points out that anti-immigrant practices offer nativist Americans, quote, a legally sanctioned opportunity to impose tyranny over a non-white population while still claiming constitutional protections for themselves, end of quote. Christina Beltran is associate professor at New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Her earlier book is The Trouble with Unity, Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity. She joins me to discuss her latest book called Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. Welcome to the program, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, of course, an approach to immigration, to examine it as part and parcel of American democracy that has been seen before, because the country has a history of determining which immigrants are legitimate and which ones aren't. And generally, it has been the white immigrants that have been seen as legitimate, or immigrants that have eventually been seen as attaining the status of whiteness. How do you see the past 4 years in particular, the Donald Trump era, as part of that historical trend of cruelty toward those people seen as other in the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think what's been so interesting is that on the one hand, you know, the situation with Donald Trump is simultaneously extraordinary and part of such a long history. So I think one thing you see is that the kinds of assaults on immigrants, particularly immigrants from Latin America, Mexico and the rest of Latin America, have been ongoing. We've seen hostility towards these populations for generations, for decades, you know, since 1848. But we've certainly seen a rise in those things starting in the mid-1990s, where you saw a lot of the sort of rise of people like Steve King and other sorts of senators and elected officials becoming increasingly virulent in their language of immigrants and their hostility towards migrants. And I think that the Trump era sort of became a moment that really highlighted the intensification of that rhetoric. And it also showed a kind of new suturing of sort of the way we want to, or the way that the Trump administration wanted to animate a sense of nativist belonging for white voters or for white citizens, and sort of to reanimate their sense of belonging via sort of more aggressive nativist politics, to give them a sense, in other words, to make their citizenship feel more valuable by denigrating non-white migrants.
Right. So that kind of messaging that Trump came into the political sphere with, I imagine, resonated quite deeply with those Americans who already saw the immigrant as somehow threatening their existence or their citizenship. But did it also not influence more Americans that might not otherwise have felt that way? I mean, we certainly see a much greater percentage of Americans influenced by Trumpism and Trumpist policies after 4 years of a leader relentlessly banging on this drum than we saw in 2016, right? And leaders have the power to deeply influence people's views.
Yeah, definitely. And we saw that. We saw two things happening. I mean, I think one of the things that really interested me about the question of, we've been seeing this rise in nativism over, like I said, especially maybe in the last 20 years, we've seen a particular kind of spike in the sort of anti-immigrant rhetoric in certain places, and particularly within the Republican Party. And that's happened. What's been kind of interesting is that this has happened simultaneously with the fact that if you look at the Gallup polls, that in the last 25 years or so, overall, Americans have become more comfortable with immigration and less nativist in their views. Like if you look at the Gallup polls from 1996, there was more anxiety about immigration than recent polling, which shows a much lower number of people. It was sort of in the highs. It was in the mid 60s in the 1990s. Today, it's around 35%. The numbers of people who think immigrants are a threat or a problem has actually gone down over the last 20 years. So one of the contradictions that we see now is that there's a smaller population of white voters who are more animated by anti-immigrant sentiment, right? So this population has been sort of animated. It kind of reminds me of the gun control debate, in the sense that there are fewer Americans now who own guns, but the ones who do own guns have more of them and are more aggressive around gun ownership. So there's this kind of narrowing but intensification. And I think Trump really added to that creation of that intensification on the one hand. And so the demand for the vitriol. And so that was one of the things I was trying to kind of make sense of, is how is it that with actually immigration numbers going down since 2015, especially from Mexico, why is this hostility ratcheting up, right? And so on the one hand, you have populations that are, you know, more upset and angry and worked up about immigration. And then you also have a segment of the population that Trumpism has also galvanized, which are Americans who didn't see immigration as a particularly significant issue for them, who have now become more positive towards immigrants. So it's causing this sort of heightened partisanship and this sort of intensified divide between those who have been sort of drawn into Trumpism and find a great deal of meaning and satisfaction in anti-migrant rhetoric and policy, and those who are repulsed by it, and it pushed them away from the Republican Party. So we're sort of seeing a bifurcation. And the other thing I think that's interesting about that break is that after 4 years of Trumpism, we would have thought that Latino voters in particular would be moving further away from the Republican Party. And what 2020 showed was that actually certain segments of Latinx voters and Asian American voters got drawn into Trumpism. And I think that is the other part of this story, which talks about the fact that when we talk about whiteness and white supremacy, we're talking about an ideology of domination. And that ideology of domination can get can draw people in whether they're white or not. So whiteness here is a political color.
Right. So in fact, that was exactly going to be my question. It seems as though that hardcore Trump supporting base is actually less driven by loss of economic power rather than the loss of political power.
Yeah, that is very true. And that was shown. We saw that in the data. I'm a political scientist by training, although I'm a political theorist. So I do democratic theory. I don't do data analysis as much. But one of the things I talk about in the book is looking at what political scientists have found. And they found that the arguments that Trump voters were drawn to Trump because of economic anxiety was actually, that's been sort of disproven by a lot of the data, that in fact, a lot of Trump voters, the thing that made a Trump voter often was anxiety about status, anti-Muslim sentiment and anti-immigrant sentiment. Those voters who showed the highest levels of anxiety around immigration, and those voters who showed sort of the highest levels of concern about the loss of white standing, actually, who felt that white people, for example, were being discriminated against. That was the population that was more drawn to Trump. It wasn't just being a white working class voter. It was really about this anxiety about status.
We know that, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the origins of this nation with respect to, you know, being steeped in white supremacy have resulted in ebbs and flows of immigration policy, but generally veered towards cruelty when it comes to immigration. But also, of course, we have simultaneously this cruel history of slavery, the legacy of which continues today. How within your analysis, where does the broader movement for racial justice fit in, particularly when it comes to African Americans?
Yeah, I think that's so key. And it's really something that I wanted to explore in the book, because as I began thinking about, I'm finishing another book right now, actually, that looks at a lot of Latino conservatives. So I'd actually been looking at Latinx conservatives. And then when Trump was elected, I realized I really wanted to understand where conservatism was and where whiteness was as an ideology, because it seemed like it was on the upswing in this way. And in reading that history and really delving into it, one thing I was so struck by that I think we don't think about enough is how slavery and anti-blackness and Jim Crow was a deeply democratic and participatory politics. And I think we don't think about that so often. So I think, so for example, when we talk about Jim Crow or the Black Codes during slavery, that one of the things, not only was violence and domination and exclusion and violence legally sanctioned, but it was an activity that Americans got to enact in their daily lives, right? So anti-blackness has been a participatory endeavor. If you lived in the South, for example, or in the Southwest, when it came to Juan Crow against Mexicans, for example, you could, you know, if you were a waitress, if you were a hotel clerk, if you were a bus driver, you could tell people, you could tell Black people where to sit, where to move. You could demand of them, you could police their bodies and make demands on them in terms of where they could occupy public space. You could keep them out of certain parks. And that didn't just happen. We sometimes think of Jim Crow as like the Black and white, drinking fountains as this sort of paradigmatic idea. But what I think is important is that Jim Crow wasn't simply a self-sorting process. It was a process where white citizens got to police Black bodies and take pleasure in that and take pleasure in knowing what spaces could be kept white and what spaces could be kept Black, right? And so I think that participatory democratic element that made people feel free and it made people feel equal to each other as white citizens is a really important element of why today attacking non-citizens, attacking migrants, is such a compelling space, is that it lets them revisit that earlier practice. It lets them return to a moment where they can invoke the law to exclude people. And after 1964 and 65 with the Voting Rights Acts, you're not really allowed to do that anymore. I mean, people still try, but they're not really legally sanctioned to do that kind of racial violence.
And so now, immigrants of color then offer that foil for whiteness and white democracy to assert its dominance.
It offers that form of release, and it allows them to do it in this legally sanctioned way. And it makes their citizenship feel meaningful in part because of that sort of policing. And I think that issue of figuring out not only what sort of anxieties do immigrants create for these populations, but I think the thing I wanted to explore were what sort of participatory political pleasures are they getting from not only doing violence to migrants, whether they're acting in militias or as ICE agents, or as even just going to a Trump rally and speaking violence. And then later we saw with the attack on the Capitol, another example where like sort of white mob violence was enacted in this moment that, you know, people sort of had been almost trained to do that at Trump rallies.
Wow. You use the term in your book, herrenfolk democracy. Tell me the origin of that term and why you use it.
Yeah, I was really interested in that idea because it was a term used by a scholar named Pierre de Berg, who was studying, doing a comparative analysis of the U.S. and South Africa and Mexico, I believe. And one of the things, and he uses this term, and the term got sort of picked up by other scholars of whiteness. And one of the points he makes about herrenfolk democracy is he says, it is a practice that is democratic for the master race, but tyrannical for subordinate groups. And that seemed really important to me because What I thought
was, it's a German term, just as
right, Herrenvolk, a sort of master race. Yeah. So it's sort of the sort of, so it implies a kind of master race. But the idea of the Herrenvolk, that it could be democratic for that master race, but tyrannical to others, seemed important to me, because I think one of the elements of white democracy, and so I argue that Herrenvolk democracy is sort of one iteration of white democracy. White democracy is sort of a larger term, because I think white democracy can happen even when it's no longer legally sanctioned. People can, like, you know, under the Trump era, there are certain people trying to enact white democracy even though it's no longer legally sanctioned. Herrenvolk democracy is a particular form of it that is sanctioned under, say, the apartheid era or the apartheid era in the US, right? And I think that that language of it being tyrannical to others, what struck me as important about that is that the people who engage in that kind of politics see themselves as law-abiding. In fact, they see the acts of racial domination they do as a form of enacting the rule of law, right? So they don't see themselves as lawbreakers, and they don't, even when they exceed the law, right? Even when they engage in lynchings or other forms of extra-legal activity,
or
they
the often January 6th riot on the Capitol.
I mean, people keep saying that during the riot, people were like, what a bunch of idiots. These people weren't wearing masks, and they were filming themselves and videotaping themselves. But, you know, the kind of, based on the kind of historical research of, you know, when you look at the United States and the history of white mob violence, there is nothing unique about that. In fact, that's been more the case. Most of the groups of kind of white, you know, mobs out there often called themselves things like Sons of Liberty.
They would engage
in a lynching, and then underneath the body, they would write the words justice. Mm. So the fact that they understood themselves as both protected by the rule of law, but themselves also being free to wield the law in these violent ways, they saw themselves as enacting their citizenship. They didn't see themselves as lawless or as doing anything wrong. And I think that's a really important element of the politics of whiteness that we're seeing right now.
So, and I'm not sure if you covered this aspect in your book, so do you then, based on this analysis of yours and the historical framework, does the evolution of the Republican Party to what it is today then in a way make sense?
I think it does completely. I mean, I think the break in the party in 1964 when Goldwater was nominated, and Goldwater had been opposed to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That moment, Goldwater lost by a landslide in that election. And then when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, a lot of people said, oh, it's sort of the Goldwater moment just took, you know, 16 years to get here, but it actually, you know, came back. It kind of finally made its full emergence. And so I think the Republican Party has, you know, occasionally we've had presidents like the Bushes who have tried for a certain kind of neoliberal multiculturalism and tried to invoke that kind of multicultural conservatism. But on the whole, the party has consistently invested itself in white resentment. And I think it's sort of thought it could control this beast, but it's been playing with white resentment, and it has been invoking it and creating the conditions for this for decades now. And so I think that it's not shocking that it finally sort of grew in this way that makes it very difficult for the party to control, is because they have been invested in this idea. And I think, you know, the element that I think we don't think enough about, that I tried to write about, is that Jim Crowism was a bipartisan affair in the 50s and the 60s. White Southern Democrats, you know, were some of the main, you know, engineers of Jim Crow. White Southern Democrats became Republicans starting in the late 1960s. Like the shift of sort of pro, you know, white grievance politics, that segment of the Democratic Party moved into the Republican Party. And so you have people like Strom Thurmond, who were Democrats, who became Republicans. And so that shift, I think, is telling, because the part of the US political history, the part of this country's legacy of politicians who've been willing to deny people the franchise, to deny people their rights, that's always existed. So we're sort of shocked by this authoritarian turn in Republican politics. It's the authoritarian practice of white democracy. This has been a segment of the US political class that has been consistently invested in denying rights to certain people based on race. So it doesn't surprise me that the party that has cultivated nativism is the part that is rolling back voting rights. And that is, you know, the things that they're engaging in, it used to just be aimed at African Americans. Their authoritarianism is now a more multiracial project, but it is very much, I think, tied to that early history of the denial of liberal constitutional rights for some Americans.
I think that was such an important segue. The issue of who is seen as a legitimate voter, quote unquote, is very much in the news these days, underpinning the Republican push to suppress voting rights. You know, right after the 2020 election began the efforts to not explore how the party could actually better attract voters, but how the party could simply reduce those people who it thinks shouldn't vote so that it can win elections and basically become a party of white minority rule. I mean, we see these Republican lawmakers talk about the integrity of voting, which is just essentially code, right, for who has the right to vote and who doesn't, based upon their conservatism and or race, which are, of course, deeply intertwined. It's becoming more and more overt.
Yeah, I mean, it really, what's so interesting is that, you know, we have never had a voter fraud problem in this country ever. We have had a voter turnout problem. And even with the high numbers of people voting in 2020, there are still millions and millions of Americans who don't vote, who are eligible to vote, who don't participate. So we've always had a turnout. That's our democratic challenge, is getting more people to vote. And the fact that these folks want fewer people to vote. And it also speaks to, I think, the thing that you raised, which is this idea that they see themselves, there's a real difference between eligibility and the people who see themselves as the real America, and we've been hearing that rhetoric on the right for a long time, that the heartland is the real America, and somehow coastal cities that are full of people of color and immigrants and more progressive politics are somehow not real America. But that really, that logic has really deepened to this, I think, this idea that I think there's a fundamental belief by a lot of these folks that they need to protect the electorate, which they think of as like the true America, and that is not the entire nation. And I think, you know, when you see some of this language of like Antifa, it was really interesting. If you listen to Trump's speech during the Mount Rushmore speech during the 4th of July, it was not a speech just against like BLM. That was some of the language, but it was really this anxiety actually about other kind of voters, like the obsession with Antifa. It's this idea of a multiracial coalition of Americans who are animated by a politics that's against white supremacy, that I think is seen as sort of an affront to this notion of sort of a certain kind of white democracy that's under threat. And I think you really see that they think they are protecting the electorate, because they are protecting it, because they have a certain conception of what constitutes a legitimate American. And a lot of us aren't part of that equation.
Let's take it back to migrants. The subtitle of your book, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy, is important, especially I want to bring it back to the fact that you said there was a time when Jim Crow racism was a bipartisan affair. Today we see President Joe Biden being scrutinized for policies that are leading to huge numbers of unaccompanied minors trying to get across the U.S. border because families aren't allowed in still, and there are thousands of young people being held in terrible conditions. It is to the advantage, even political advantage, of Democrats to be compassionate. And of course, there's challenges to all of that. How do you view the modern Democratic Party's approach to immigration within the historic arc of how we've treated immigrants?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, because just as white supremacy for a very long time, and you know, you could say even to this day, but I think that the two parties have really veered off, and one side deciding to be part of to try to forge a more multiracial coalition, and the other side wanting diverse voters but not wanting that kind of multiracial collective rule. I think there is a real divide there. But I think one thing you do see around immigration is that bad immigration policy has been a bipartisan affair, right? We've seen some of the worst policies towards immigrants happened under Bill Clinton. 1996 Welfare Act denied things like food stamps and Medicaid to legal immigrants. That was one of the first laws that began denying legal immigrants welfare state resources. And we saw with the Obama administration, which Joe Biden was a part of, they had their own occasionally very quite violent practices that they didn't crow about. But there was this feeling that I think that there was a different kind of initial approach until 2012, when migrant activists really shifted the conversation, and they got policies that began to transform that in terms of DACA, et cetera, right? But I think that and the idea that we could sort of actually support Dreamers, but that was something that was pushed by migrant activists that didn't come from the Democratic Party establishment. So the Democratic Party has struggled with how, in part because they know this is such a passionate issue for a segment of voters, this anxiety. And so I think that the Democratic Party has been sort of, you know, participating in some of the uglier practices of anti-immigrant policies and then trying to do something better. And so I think the task now is to figure out a sane and sensible, you know, discussion about the movement, the movement of people as something that is normal and natural, and sort of thinking about how do we think about the movement of people in the context of crisis, in the context of refugee politics, in the context of economics. And I think that the Democratic Party continues to struggle with this question of trying to perform certain notions of sovereignty that can be very violent towards people, while also assuaging anxieties of citizens. And I think a lot of this has to do with our own crisis in citizenship. It's like, what does citizenship actually mean? What does it, you know, I think one thing that Trumpism was very good at was not so much making citizenship a valuable category, but only making it valuable because it could be denied to others, right? So your citizenship was meaningful because violence could be enacted on non-citizens. So it didn't make our citizenship richer or more participatory or more, you know, beneficial to citizens. It was simply the pleasure of knowing that those people have even less and are subject to more degradation and deprivation. And so that makes my citizenship meaningful.
It sort of reminds me of the whole debate around same-sex marriage and how allowing same-sex couples to wed was somehow going to degrade the quality of heterosexual marriages and vice versa.
White supremacy is a really, the politics of whiteness is a scarcity logic, right? It is, like you said, it's a zero-sum logic that says there's not enough, you know, of the benefits of citizenship or the benefits that the only way that this can work is if some people are denied, and then it makes me feel freer that you don't have it, as opposed to a politics that we could all, you know, live in safety and security and in a condition of justice. Yeah.
Well, Christina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website where people can find out more about your work?
You can go to my website, is thetroublewithunity.com. It's named after my first book. There's information there. But thank you so much for having
me.
I think we're in an hopefully we're in a better moment today. I'm thinking we're going somewhere positive.
Thank you so much, Christina. Again, that website is thetroublewithunity.com. My guest has been Christina Beltran, Associate Professor in New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Her earlier book was The Trouble with Unity, Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity. We've just been talking about her latest book, Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Inequality in America, already sky high before the coronavirus hit, has been greatly exacerbated by the pandemic. But understanding poverty in the world's richest nation has always been a challenge. Media narratives and politicians' rhetoric fuels the perception that poverty is what someone else experiences. But in fact, poverty is widespread in America and affects nearly everyone at some point in their lives. Understanding poverty, who it affects, how it can be addressed, what works and what doesn't, is critical to fixing the nation's deep economic inequality. My guest and author has launched an ambitious effort to that end. Mark Rank is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis. He's widely recognized as one of the foremost experts and speakers in the country on issues of inequality, poverty, and social justice. He's written numerous books and also created a website called Confronting Poverty. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, co-authored with Lawrence Eppert and Heather Bullock, called Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks, Sonali. Great to be with you.
So let's talk about how widespread poverty first is. As I mentioned, it's often seen as something that happens to someone else. But in fact, most of us in America, unless we're born into, you know, massive independent wealth, experience poverty at some point in our lives. So how do you explain how widespread it is?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. And that's where we start in the book, is this question of what's the likelihood across an American's life of experiencing poverty. We often, when we talk about poverty, we often speak of how many folks are poor in a given year, but this is a different way of looking at it. So if we look, for example, between the ages of 20 and 75, what we find is that 60% of the American population will experience at least 1 year below the official poverty line. And 3/4 of Americans will experience either poverty or very near poverty. So poverty is something that touches the vast majority of Americans. And I think a lot of people would be surprised by that.
And when you say poverty, we're talking about what exactly? The ability to, you know, put gas in the tank, or the ability to make your next bill payment. You might be asset rich, but cash poor.
Yeah, so the way that we define poverty in the United States, the way the Census Bureau does, is to say if you fall below a certain income level, we're going to count you as in poverty, and if you fall above that level, we're not going to count you as in poverty. So for a household of three persons last year, the poverty line was around $20,000. So if that family earned less than $20,000 for the year, they would be counted as in poverty. But one thing I should point out is that that represents poverty at its most opulent level. In other words, if you're a dollar over that, you're not counted as in poverty. Hmm. It turns out that 45% of all folks in poverty in the United States actually fall below half the poverty line. So instead of a family of three trying to get by on $20,000, imagine a family of three trying to get by on $10,000.
Wow. So let's talk about who exactly are America's poor. If you, you know, watch a lot of Fox News, poverty is rampant in urban centers, which is, of course, code for where Black and brown people live. Is that true?
So the way to think about this is that the reach of poverty is really wide. It touches all aspects of American society. So let's take that sort of image that a lot of people have, which is poverty is really confined to inner city areas and folks of color. It turns out that only about 10 to 15% of people that are currently in poverty actually live in high poverty neighborhoods. Today in the United States, there are more people living in poverty in suburban areas than in central cities. And some of the most deep-seated poverty in the United States is actually found in rural America. So if you look at Appalachia, or you look at the Deep South and the Mississippi Delta, or American Indian reservations, there you find extreme levels of poverty. So I think the way to think about this is that poverty is not confined to just one specific area. you can really go down almost any street or any block in any American city or location and find somebody that's probably in poverty.
Is there a reluctance on the part of Americans to admit that they have experienced or are experiencing poverty? And is that part of the problem of overcoming this?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
there's shame.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say the shame of poverty or of using a safety net program, or we might think of it as a stigma. These are groups that are highly stigmatized. Now, why is that? One of the reasons is because of the way that we have typically understood poverty in this country, and that is as an individual failing, that people aren't working hard enough, they've made bad decisions, they haven't gotten enough skills, that there's something wrong with the individual, and that's why poverty exists. And what we argue in the book is that really the reason for poverty and the reason for why it's so high in the United States is it's a structural failing. It's a failing of the economy, and it's a failing of the policy and political environments to really address the issue of poverty.
Let's talk about how long Americans might experience poverty at a time, what you call in your book, poverty spells, because it isn't that a household or an individual might be poor all their lives. They might experience it in short spells. They might experience poverty and then not, and then experience it again. What do we know about how often and for how long people experience poverty?
Yeah, I was just talking this morning to somebody about this. And, you know, we often use the phrase poor people, but that's really, that's not correct, because as you're pointing out here, most people move in and out of poverty. So they're not poor people their whole lives. So the typical spell of folks in poverty is maybe for 1 or 2 years. They then get somewhat above the poverty line. And then something may happen to them down the road which throws them back into poverty. So the way to think about this is that poverty is really quite fluid. Sure, there is a group of folks that are in poverty for long periods of time, but that's only about maybe 10% of the entire population of individuals that will experience poverty. So the way to think about it is much more fluid. And what happens, and this gets back to what we were talking about in terms of the long-term risk, over time, things occur to people that they didn't anticipate. So losing a job, a pandemic occurs, people get sick, a family splits up. All of those things have the potential to throw folks into poverty. They're there for a relatively short period of time, get back on their feet, but then something else might happen to them. So it's a much more fluid kind of picture.
Let's go back to talking about the racial breakdown of who is poor or who experiences poverty in America. You mentioned that suburban areas and rural areas is where you have rampant poverty. And these are, of course, where there's majority white populations. And indeed, the majority of American poor are whites, even if the percentage in terms of racial category of people who experience the most poverty is African American. So larger percentage of African Americans among African Americans experiencing poverty, but overall numbers, because whites are still the majority ethnic and racial group in this country, the largest group of poor people in this country is white. Is this important to understand these distinctions?
Yeah, because I think it gets at this idea of the way that we've sort of framed poverty is, as I just said, you know, as an individual failing. But another way that we framed it is that it's an issue of them and not an issue of us. And what we need to think about is what I was saying before, that is the reach of poverty is really wide. So what you're pointing out is absolutely correct. The largest group in terms of numbers in poverty are whites. But on the other hand, folks of color are certainly at a much higher risk of experiencing poverty. Both of those things are correct, and we need to keep them both in mind because they're both important. But again, I think that the image that we so often have in this country is, oh, poverty is something that happens to some other group and not to me or not to my group. And it turns out that that's really incorrect, that poverty should be thought of as an issue of us and not an issue of them.
And just to sort of maybe express that a little bit better, if you're white in America, you're the least likely to experience poverty. But if you are a poor person in America, you're the most likely to be white.
Yes. Yeah. That's another way to. Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely. But on the other hand, absolutely correct. But it's also that for the life course work that I did, looking at the overall risk across a person's adulthood of experiencing poverty, for Black Americans, that figure was close to 90%. So at some point in time, for African Americans, 90% would experience poverty.
Wow.
But for white Americans, the figure was slightly over 50%. So this isn't a small minority. Even for white Americans, a majority of them will experience poverty.
Let's talk about government welfare, which unfortunately after Reagan and after Clinton, that word itself became demonized. And if you talk to Republicans, we have far too many government handouts going to poor people in America, which is a disincentive to work, et cetera, fueling this logic that people are poor of their own volition and that giving them help actually makes them less likely to emerge from poverty. But how strong is a social safety net? How serious is American welfare? American welfare state? Is it a strong welfare state? And maybe we shouldn't include the American Rescue Plan that just passed, which some are saying is the biggest expansion of government welfare in decades.
Yeah. So the safety net or social welfare state in the United States is really, really weak. It is by far the weakest safety net of any of the kind of Western industrialized countries, and this is one reason why the United States has the highest rates of poverty among the high economy countries. So our rates of poverty, our depth of poverty, and the amount of inequality that we have in this country is far higher than any of these other countries. And the reason is, one of the reasons is, because we do so little to help people from getting into poverty. And what we basically do through our safety net is we punish people for going into poverty. We make these programs really, really difficult to get and to maintain. And that's by design. By design, we're making it difficult. And so, you know, the conservative argument that we spend all this money on welfare and these kind of programs is really, really bogus. The program that people often point to when they talk about welfare is the TANF program, which is designed largely for single moms with kids. That program is far less than 1% of the entire federal budget. So we're spending very, very little in terms of the social safety net.
There's also food stamps, which Americans rely on. That too, I understand, over the years has been decimated, or I guess it depends on who's in power and what the need is in the country at the time, right?
Yeah, it's it also, if you look at how much the average person gets from food stamps or the SNAP program, it's only a couple $100 a month. And again, we make it really difficult for people to get those kind of programs.
Does government welfare work to address poverty when you have a robust welfare system? And maybe you can talk about some of the other nations where this is true. Is there a strong correlation between addressing poverty? Is it successful? Does it actually have outcomes that match its goals?
Yeah, really good question. So the answer is most definitely. And I can point to a couple ways of thinking about this. One is what you just said, and that is if we compare the United States with other countries that are much more proactive in terms of their social safety nets, they wind up having much less poverty than the United States. But we can look at the United States too in a couple of ways to show that actually safety net programs can have a dramatic effect. So let me give you one example. In 1959, the poverty rate for the elderly in the United States was around 35%. Today, the poverty rate for the elderly is around 9 or 10%. And the only reason for that has been the expansion of the Social Security program and the Medicare program. Those have had a dramatic effect on reducing poverty for the elderly. So if we didn't have those programs today, the poverty rate for the elderly, instead of 9%, would be closer to 40%. That's a clear example of government proactively reducing the rate of poverty. The other example I give, and one that conservatives really love to sort of use, Ronald Reagan was famous for saying, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. It turns out that from 1959 to 1973, the rate of poverty in the United States was cut in half, from 22% to 11%. And there are two reasons for that. One, we had strong economic growth, but the other is we had an expansion of poverty programs through the war on poverty, and they dramatically reduced the extent of poverty. Was poverty eliminated? No, but it was dramatically reduced. So these are examples that show that government programs can actually have a quite an effective role to play in terms of reducing poverty.
Right. I mean, a lot of the narrative that Reagan fueled, that continues today, relied on racist tropes of, you know, the welfare queen, etc. So that certainly speaks to that sense of otherness, that poverty is something that those other people experience. And if they experience it, it is their fault. And if you give them help, they'll try to defraud you and take advantage of you and won't want to work. All of these build up this sense that we can't trust poor Americans to do the right thing if they are offered help. And that's a really self-defeating idea, you know, when we think about how many Americans, for example, who might be poor, who voted for Trump, although, of course, not all of Trump's voters were poor. But there is that terrible self-defeating misconception, right?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, everything that you said there is spot on. You know, we have this image that we've been talking about that these are folks that are abusing the system and so on and so forth. And really, what politicians have done, they have used these myths to their advantage. So at the kind of the end of the book, we ask this question of, okay, we go through all these different myths and show that there's really no evidence for any of them. Why do they continue? Why do these things continue? And one of the arguments we make is because they actually serve a function for some folks. Political actors have used this mythology of the poor over and over to score political points. And as you said, welfare and poverty are often used as code words for race and for Black. And politicians have used that over and over to score points. There's a great quote, I don't have it right here, but it's from Lyndon Johnson, who says, you know, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't mind you picking his pockets. And then he says, hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. And that's what we've been doing in this country over and over and over in terms of poverty and race. We've used race to divide poor whites and poor Blacks from seeing their common interests together.
One of the things that you point out in your book is that research has demonstrated that a number of poverty-stricken individuals and families who would be eligible for various safety net programs choose not to apply in order to avoid the humiliation, frustration, and stigma associated with welfare. Rather than encouraging fraud, the system would appear to be encouraging non-participation instead. This sounds to me also like self-loathing, not just otherizing poverty, but a sense of self-loathing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we're doing is, rather than fraud in the system, what it's set up to do is basically prevent people from applying for these programs. And so we really need to get over this whole mindset. Another I think really important point here that's connected to this is the question of what does poverty cost us as a society? What is the economic cost to the United States? And I did an analysis a couple years ago. And what we did is we estimated What childhood poverty does in terms of increasing our healthcare costs, because we know that poverty is associated with higher healthcare costs. What's it associated in terms of less economic productivity, because as children become adults, they're less economically productive, and the cost of childhood poverty in terms of higher criminal justice costs. And we factored those all in and came up with a conservative number that childhood poverty costs the United States on an annual basis slightly over $1 trillion. Put that in perspective, that was about 28% of the entire federal budget. So here's the deal. We can either pay for the problem on the back end, or we can pay for it on the front end. And whenever you pay for a problem on the back end, it's always much more expensive than preventing the problem in the first place. The other thing that we show is that for every dollar we spend reducing childhood poverty, we would save $7 to $12 down the road. So the point of all of this is to say, not only is reducing childhood poverty the morally right thing to do, but it's also economically the smart thing to do as well.
You mentioned healthcare. So let's talk about what are some of those simple solutions. I imagine a nationalized health plan would go a long way toward providing a social safety net for all Americans, strengthening existing programs like SNAP and TANF. What else? How would you, if you were to give advice on these seemingly pretty obvious solutions to addressing inequality, what would you tell politicians who claim to care about eradicating inequality?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in some ways, the hard part is not what the solutions are. The hard part is really having the political will to institute these solutions. So the things that you just mentioned, universal health care, every other country, every other industrialized country provides this except for the United States. That's clearly important. Making childcare accessible and affordable, affordable housing, all of those kinds of things. Another thing that I would say that actually it is in the news and will continue to be in the news is the idea of creating jobs that pay a decent wage. So, you know, right now the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, hasn't been raised since 2009. It's impossible if you're working full time on that to not be in poverty. And as President Biden says, there's something wrong that if folks are working full time, they really shouldn't fall into poverty. So raising the minimum wage up to more of a livable wage, I think would be very positive. There's talk now about things like a child allowance, which would help folks who have kids raising those children. So every month you might get some kind of a monthly cash benefit.
Right. There's in the American Rescue Plan a pretty strong expansion of child tax credits, which, you know, I suppose you and others would hope would become permanent, because it is currently temporary, but it could go such a long way towards actually putting cash in the hands of lower income families with children.
Yeah. And this is an idea that European countries have had for decades. So this isn't anything new. They've been doing this for a long period of time. But the fact that we're talking about it and actually instituted for a year this kind of policy is actually pretty remarkable. And so in some ways, I'm actually kind of guardedly optimistic that we're beginning to talk about, again, think about it as dealing with poverty on the structural level rather than on the individual. I use the example of musical chairs, and I won't go into all the detail, but what we have done is we focus all our attention on who loses out at the game rather than why the game produces losers in the first place. And what we need to do is change the structure of the game so that there are fewer losers in the first place.
Finally, what do you think needs to happen to address the sort of culture war around poverty that you do talk about and that we've discussed, that sense of shame, that refusal to acknowledge that there is class in America and strong class differences, and there is a class war being waged against the poor by the rich, and that it's not something to be ashamed of, to experience poverty. It seems as though obviously your book goes a long way toward addressing that, but unless your book is, you know, going to be covered by Fox News or properly addressed and properly read and explained by media narratives, or maybe, you know, have free copies distributed nationwide, how do we address these issues?
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes there are some folks that you're just never going to convince.
Yeah.
What we've tried to do here is to say, look, let's look at this clear-eyed from an objective point of view and show you what the reality is versus the myths. And there is absolutely no question that these myths do not stand up at all. But I think you've touched on this, and I think this is so important, that the moral ground for us to look at poverty in the United States is not one of individual blame. It should be one of moral outrage and injustice. That is, in a country with these resources and wealth, there is something fundamentally wrong and unfair about such a high percentage of the population being in poverty. We need to be outraged at that situation rather than using that old trope of individual blame.
Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And actually, give out that website that you've also helped to create and how you think that can be a way for people to spread more information.
Yeah, so I have a website that actually is getting a lot of play. Folks come from all over the world, and it's you just type in confrontingpoverty.org. And what it does, and there's a lot of really great information on there, but it has, I developed a poverty risk calculator. So you can go there, you put in some of your background characteristics, and you can see what your actual risk of poverty is in the next 5, 10, or 15 years. And if you do that, I'll bet you're going to be pretty surprised. So so please make use of that. It's all free and accessible to anybody who wants to use it.
Confrontingpoverty.org again is that website, and we'll link to it. Mark, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much, Sonali. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Mark Rank. He is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis and a widely recognized expert on issues of inequality, poverty, and social justice. We've been talking about his newest book, co-authored with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock, called Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatka. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.